There is a quote that we will all know, and it is, history is written by the victors, and it's well known. Well, there's another quote that caught the Thursday Daily's producer, Ben Coleman's eye recently, and that was, the Aboriginal women amazed the British sailors, where are all the women's sights? Now, they're quotes from Professor Grace Karskens, and she's part of the team that uncovered 170 new Aboriginal place names along the Jerubbin. That's known as the Hawkesbury River at the moment, and it's home to 50,000 years of Aboriginal history. Professor Grace joins us now to discuss some of the roles of the Aboriginal women at the time of European settlement. Good morning, Professor Grace. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Good morning.
Now, tell us about your collaborative research, the work that you did with the Jarug people in uncovering these 170 Aboriginal place names around the Hawkesbury River.
It's been one of the best projects I think I've ever worked on. It came about through a chance find in the wonderful Mitchell Library, which was a long lost list of Aboriginal names for places along the Hawkesbury. And 5 pages neatly written by a Presbyterian minister named John McGarvey, and he wrote them in 1829. And we know that he knew a lot of Aboriginal people on the river from his diary, and so we know that he's asked them and they've shared them with him. And I can't tell you how excited I was to find that, because most of the names have disappeared under colonisation. When people make maps, they are actually exerting power, aren't they? Because
yeah,
they're actually
absolutely
imposing new names, and they're making maps showing what's important to them. So if you look at a parish map or a modern map, you know, listeners will know that you'll see boundaries and houses and mostly settler names. There are a few Aboriginal ones. But in effect, what our maps did and what the settlers did was try to wipe out that earlier layer of place names. And place names are super important because they're like cultural artifacts. They tell you about the way of life. They tell you about spiritual beliefs. They tell you about the ecologies of those places. So, yeah, I am absolutely stoked by this project.
I know. Wonderful to that minister as well for writing all those names down. I mean, you know, that was it was great that it was captured in a language that, you know, the colonisers could understand in the future.
Exactly. And not only that, the fact that the traditional owners shared them with him,
they must have wanted him
to record them. But the other thing he did with about 100 out of the 170 was record the places where they belonged. So he noted the name of the farmer, which means we can actually locate them back on the map. So it's one thing to have a list of names. It's quite another thing to know where they belong. So that's what we've been doing. We've been putting them back on the map.
Oh, that is such an exciting project, like you said. So how did this become to be known as the real secret river?
We're obviously riffing off the famous novel, The Secret River, but the novel doesn't really deal with Aboriginal culture at all. And we think this is the real secret river. This is the one that was lost and has become secret, but it's the real story about the Aboriginal people on Jerubbin. So we came together in 2017. We designed a project and we applied for the wonderful State Library Coral Thomas Fellowship, and that was what funded this project. So, yeah, it's been fantastic because we've had a lot of people on board contributing their time and their expertise to this project.
What about the Sydney Harbour and the many Aborigines that lived alongside it at the time of colonisation? How did the Aboriginal women amaze the British sailors there?
Well, this was part of my earlier work published in the book The Colony, A History of Early Sydney. I was determined to tell both stories, both the settler story and the much longer Aboriginal story. But I'm really interested in what happened when they encountered one another. And what I discovered is, although you often see, you know, the term Aboriginal people, Aboriginal groups, clans, it's actually a very gendered society. And women, the coastal women, were absolutely splendid canoeists and fisherwomen. And I followed the story by looking at artefacts like the burra, which is the beautiful shell hook, which has only been used in the Sydney region for around 1,000 years. We think that's what the archaeologists think. So it could have come from Polynesia. But anyway, what they think is that women could take this hook. It enabled them to go out further from the shoreline and catch different sorts of fish. And they were the main food providers for their families and groups. So, you know, women made everything happen in early Sydney, and they absolutely dominated the harbour. And the reason the officers were impressed and the sailors was because they were so amazingly brave and skillful in these canoes. So they'd watch them in the biggest surf in these, they looked like just fragile bark canoes. And they'd have a baby on their lap and a child behind them and a little fire in front of them to cook the fish as they caught it so they could have a feed before they took the rest home for the rest of their family, for their men. And they just said, look, they paddle in waves that would scare our oldest sailors. You know, they were in awe of them because they were so amazingly skilled. And that was my point in the story last week, that they, that was their domain, and they were so much admired for their skills. Where are the sites that remember the great Eora fisherwomen?
Yeah, and did they survive for a while and cohabitate with the European settlers? How long before that kind of all went south?
Well, going south or disintegrating tends to be a white term. Yes, there were massive disruptions because of dispossession in various places, though it's uneven over country, like where there are farms, the dispossession is worse and worse, and frontier conflict breaks out. But Aboriginal people came, you know, basically Sydney was a tiny little pimple on a huge continent. And the Aboriginal people all around, all the clans around, basically went on living the way they were. They just were annoyed by people like convicts roaming in their country and taking their food, and the convicts copped it. They got speared. So it was violent in that way. They were warning them to just stay in Sydney. So it's a very different idea from the idea that the British come and they're all powerful and they shoot everybody and they'd own everything. That's actually not what happened. There's a long coexistence. There's a long lot of negotiations where Philip and the officers want some Aboriginal people to come and live in Sydney so they can show them the, in inverted commas, the benefits of civilization. And of course they succeed with Bennelong and his people. They come in, they come and live in Sydney, and Aboriginal people have never left since then. And we can see that the Eora fisherwomen were still fishing in the 1820s. You can see that in paintings and artefacts. So, and as other people have shown, like Heather Goodall and Paul Irish, Aboriginal people never disappeared. They still live in Sydney. They just lived in different areas.
They were, yeah. Oh, look, Professor Carskins, I could talk to you all morning. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.